Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting through our studios in New York, not on camera today because we're filming. We're going to talk a little later in the program about health and healing, such as reasons to break a sweat. Also, we're going to look at a comment from George Monbiot from England, why he believes that the only way to get a handle on the environment is for everyone to cut out or cut back on animal product consumption. I'll share that. It's a very insightful commentary. Also, crabapple. Well, something in crabapple is going to lower your cholesterol. From Beijing and Shanghai universities, the latest studies on that. And this is your brain on God. Spiritual experiences activate brain reward circuits. Some really good research from the University of Utah that shows that religious and spiritual experiences activate the brain reward circuits in much the same way as love or sex, or for some people, gambling, drugs, and music does. So I'll share that with you. Also, aerobic exercise preserves your brain volume. That's good. And improves cognitive functioning. Wake Forest School of Medicine. And also, well, as you see, we have a lot to share. But normally, we start with health and nutrition. But my guest today has to come on first because he has other commitments. And also, today, we're going to take a look in our issues of how think tanks generate endless wars, a piece from Consortium News by Todd Pierce. Also, we're going to look at some frightening statistics about how much we're in debt and how we got there and why we have to do something about it. And there's a land grab congressman now wants President Trump to abolish national monuments. That's 270 million acres of American land and waters are potentially at risk, an area 2.5 times the size of California. Why didn't we know about this? And commentary today from Pascal Emmanuel Gobry from The Week, America now looks like Rome before the fall of the Republic. And also, West Antarctica ice shelf is breaking up from inside out. This is the latest from the American Geophysical Union. Researchers are tracing the origins of this giant iceberg, and it is big. 225 square miles of iceberg broke off from the glacier. Well, there's bigger ones behind that, and that's not good news because that shows that what's happening in the West Antarctic area could be speeding up tremendously the amount of water that is coming on to our shores each night in the high tides. So as you see, we have a lot to share, but let's go first to my guest who is standing by. Many of you know him as one of the most insightful economists in the world today. He is Professor Michael Hudson, and he is an important voice where there are so many irresponsible voices in the area of economics. And Wall Street financial analysis. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts recently called him, quote, the world's best economist. He's currently the president of the Institution for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and the chief economic policy advisor to many countries. Actual whole countries bring him in to help them get out of the problems that they're in. He is an author of Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy, which goes into great depth in explaining how the polarization of the 1% versus the 99% emerged. His website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
It's good to be back with you, Gary.
Michael, I'm, like a lot of people, I'm concerned with the euphoria of the market because on the one hand, we have Wall Street that is likely to hit 20,000, by January, it's now at 19,000, the most in its history. And yet, when I look around, I see a lot of companies scaling back, companies moving, companies closing. 102 million Americans who could work and have worked who are not working now, and they're not even a percentage of the 5% or 4.8% unemployment rate. It's more like 24 to 26% actual unemployment. But then there's some figures that I put together, accurate figures, that we're not discussing. No one's discussing. The only figure anyone will discuss is the current national U.S. debt is $19.9 trillion. Let's round it off to $20 trillion. Some people, of course, know that we have $1.4 trillion in student debt, but they're not talking about the personal debt held by American citizens of $17 trillion, the mortgage debt of $14 trillion, the credit card debt of $987 billion. Plus, they're not talking about the unfunded liabilities of $104.3 trillion. Now, you add all that together, and you see that we're dealing with over $170 trillion in debt with a gross domestic product at a little over $18 trillion. And that's not accurate because a good percentage of that, let's say gross domestic product, are people buying things who are in debt, who have no savings, sometimes have no job, on their credit cards. That also shows you a lot of the financial transactions out of Wall Street that do not actually help the larger economy. They're not building factories in the United States. They're not employing people. So if you looked at the real figure, as close as I can come, it's 1,020% debt to gross domestic product. If you bring that figure up to anyone, they say, well, that's not very good for the people who are holding the debt or are owed the debt. But also it shows that we're virtually in bankrupt as a country. There's prosperous people, of course, and about 50 to 60 million Americans who are doing just fine. But for the vast majority, over 270 million Americans, they're in deep debt and are not going to get out. So could you look at this for us and try to make sense of how did we get into this much debt, why we're not doing anything to talk about it, and what would happen if we actually begin to change our economic model?
Well, Gary, you almost always begin by talking about two different things. You begin by talking about the stock market and going up and saying it was bewildering, which it is. And then you talked about the economy and the debt. The economy isn't the stock market. When you talk about debt, you're absolutely right. The economy is still mired in debt deflation. In 2008, the banks were saved. The big investors were saved, and the 1% were saved, but not the 99%, not the economy. And the economies, indeed, as you've just discussed, got poorer by going into debt. However, the stock market has got rich by going into debt. And that's because, well, most homeowners and most of your listeners have to pay maybe 5 or 6% for their mortgages, and they have to pay up to 29% on their credit cards, and they have to pay 8.5%, I think, on student debt. That's really hard to carry. But the brokerage houses and the investment banks have reclassified themselves as banks, and they can borrow from the Federal Reserve at only 0.1%. And this money, this $4.3 trillion in reserves that are created by the Federal Reserve, doesn't even count as public debt because there seems to be a quid pro quo there. And basically, they've been extending this credit largely for investment banks to fund corporate takeovers, investment buyouts, and basically to buy stocks on margin that can yield much higher than 0.1%. If stocks yield maybe 4 or 5%, and you can borrow, let's say, 1% in order to buy stocks yielding a higher dividend, then you've made arbitrage. And so what's happened is that the basically low interest by the Federal Reserve from its money helicopter that only drops money over Wall Street, not over the economy, but it drops money over Wall Street to push up the stock market. So all the stock market run-up and the bond market run-up has been very largely by Federal Reserve money creation for the financial sector, which is basically for the 1%. Now, what's bewildering about the stock market going up so much is everybody said that when the Federal Reserve begins to raise the interest rates If they really raise the interest rates to a serious level, that means companies are not going to make a profit. Banks are not going to make a profit by borrowing cheap and buying stocks. So they're going to begin selling all the stocks that they've bought on margin. They'll take their money and run. And when they take the money and run, then the stocks are going to begin to go down because all of these stocks bought on credit are going to be sold off as the borrowings from the Fed are wound down and the debts are paid off. So people cannot really figure out why the stock market's going up except that they believe that the laws are going to be rewritten, the tax laws, the deregulation, and that Donald Trump is going to bring in a regime that is so good for companies, meaning so bad for the economy, that the companies are going to be able to make predatory gains from the rest of the economy and more than offset the earnings from these predatory gains are going to more than offset the sales of the stock as the Federal Reserve raises interest rates.
So what does this portend for the average person and what it looks like it's happening? Because there are several things happening simultaneously. This new president, the people he has selected, are all major corporatists.
Yep.
They're, if you look at their history, some of these people, like the person who is handling his education, Secretary of Education, doesn't believe in public education, didn't put her four children through public education, and wants to go the charter school route and give vouchers. Well, how does that then help America's major schools? The man who is this Wilbur who is brought in, he is a man who's made his money off taking companies that were going bankrupt, and then also he was not good to the workers of those companies.
Right.
And so how's he supposed to be someone who is going to help as Secretary of Commerce to help people who need jobs when he's done just the opposite?
Yep.
It makes no sense to me. And the new Secretary of the Treasury is a person that was a partner in Goldman Sachs and a big financier in Hollywood, but he again is in that very gilded group that only considers their own interests or the people around them, but not the general public. How are these people supposed to do anything that represents a step forward for the American public?
I don't think they're trying to represent the public. They're representing themselves, and they're representing Wall Street. So one way or the other, you could have had the Democrats and Hillary put in her Wall Street people from Goldman Sachs, or you can have Donald Trump represent his Wall Street people in Goldman Sachs. Neither group is trying to make sense to you or to your listeners. They're really out for Wall Street, and they each of them have a constituency that sort of backed Wall Street and contributed to their campaign. So this is not good news for the economy or for your listeners, but it's good news for the 1%.
I still don't know where Trump is going to get all this money if he gives huge tax breaks to corporations down to 15%, because you know that the major corporations have the money and to buy the services of lawyers and tax experts to make sure they don't pay any taxes sometimes at all. Even 15% they wouldn't pay.
Yep.
So, but they're still going to be making these deals with them. So where is the money to run our government supposed to come from?
Nobody knows, Gary. Certainly I don't know. That's the big question. The only place it can come from is the government simply printing the money. And this will not necessarily be inflationary. If it only prints the money to benefit Wall Street and to buy stocks and bonds, it does not mean that consumer prices are going to go up. It certainly doesn't mean that wages are going to go up, so consumers have more money to spend. It means that the government will print the money and basically provide it in giveaway deals. The way that Trump has described things, the money is going to come from public investment in infrastructure at giveaway prices in exchange for huge tax credits and tax breaks, so that essentially there will be an appearance of the government remaining solvent if private companies will buy out the public domain, will buy the roads, will buy control of the bridges, and essentially the government would sell a bridge, say, for a dollar, any big bridge for a dollar to a private investor under the private public partnership. The investor will then spend maybe $1 million in rebuilding the bridge, and then he'll put a toll booth. He'll turn the bridge into a toll booth, and he'll make $10 million, maybe $100 million if you're Goldman Sachs, and everybody's going to have to pay tolls instead of having the government rebuild the bridges by spending. So the idea is that tax cuts for the rich will be funded by a huge sale of roads, sewer systems, water systems, bridges, the whole public lands out west, forestry, water rights, all to Wall Street speculators that will then make a killing and turn the whole economy into a really high-cost economy, so that probably the cost of living may double for most workers, meaning yet more defaults, more foreclosures, and the foreclosures will be bought by the Wall Street banks and investment banks, and home ownership will be turned back into rental property, and you're really going to have a winding down of the economy into a kind of early 19th century model. In Russia, they call this kleptocracy. I'm not sure what they're going to call it for the American version.
Tumpocracy.
Right.
Now, I have one example of Representative Robert Bishop. He is a anti-public lands advocate. He's a Republican from Utah, and he is being spoken with Trump to abolish all of our national monuments, and that's 270 million acres of land, and he does not believe Americans should have the right to these public commons, these parks and lakes. Instead, he believes that this would be a good income producer, and then you look at who's been giving him money, and you see that he accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars, $452,610 in oil, gas, and coal interest, according to Dirty Energy Money, and also more than 10% has come from coal-friendly National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, which has been the leading fight against Obama's clean coal. He got money from ExxonMobil, Chevron, Tesoro, and a bankrupt Arch Coal. So I believe that what we see with him, we're going to start seeing across the board with people trying to make America like Greece. Yep. And at some point, Americans are going to be put on to very strict, and I believe it'll come through Medicare modification, Medicaid modification programs, especially with the abandonment of Obamacare, which was a disaster. But then what are you going to do with the people in the marketplace who cannot afford the private insurance companies' fees? So I believe that we're going to see America become Greece. I believe we're going to go through austerity programs, because everyone he has selected for every single position supports that. And lastly, when you think that here's a person that is bringing in Mitt Romney, and the whole emphasis with Mitt Romney was what he said about Donald Trump when he was running for president himself, and they're not looking at the fact that Bain Capital bought corporations as equity partners, put up a small percentage, bought it for far more than what it should have been paid for, took that extra money above beyond the actual value of the company for themselves, and then drained on a regular basis any money that did come into the companies they took as their fees, management fees, and in the process, over 7,000 workers lost their jobs. And then he also has got a negotiating person with as an advisor with Henry Kravitz, and Kravitz is he is the king of equity partnerships. And you look back over the last 40 years, and you're going to total about 30 million jobs lost because of corporate downsizing, equity partnerships, buying companies. And these are the people who are going to be advising you?
Well, there you are, Gary. You've just explained where the money's coming from. The money's going to come from, I think, just the way you described, selling off the public domain and privatizing everything. It's sort of like George Soros' plan for the Ukraine. privatize it all. You're right. The plan is, if you do all this and you cut the taxes on the corporate tax rates and the rates for the high-income people, you're not going to have enough to pay Social Security and Medicare. So, there is enough in the program now, but you're going to essentially empty out these programs and do what George Bush said, George W. Bush, and he said, you know, they're really this money is really all fictitious in the program. It's really just used for tax cuts, and it's not really there. So, yes, they're going to cut back the medical care program. They're going to cut back Medicaid. They're going to cut back Social Security. That's where the money's coming from.
Wow. And, you know, part of the problem, Michael, is the hubris and the arrogance of the so-called liberal Democratic community.
Yep.
Who believe that Trump would never become president, and they would fix things. And yet you look back over the last 32 years, from Reagan through Clinton and Bush and then Obama, and Hillary have been no different than any of them.
Yep.
None of that was fixing anything.
Well, remember that the Americans voted in Trump as the lesser evil. You had both candidates being the two most unpopular politicians in America. And I think a lot of Americans are right to view to view Trump as the lesser evil, because at least he doesn't want atomic war with Russia. And they felt that Hillary was a military and was self-serving. So essentially, all that the Americans can do when you have two parties that are identical, at least they can throw out the existing party, and that's the game that's been played. You give them two parties that are exactly the same, and you let them vote for exactly which party will administer exactly the same program, and that's the only choice that we have under the two-party system, as opposed to, say, the European parliamentary system, where there actually could be a third party that would be represented proportionally to its votes in Parliament. So the problem, given our political system, I don't see any way out for the what you've just described as America's future.
Final question for you. What do you see over the next couple, 2 years, happening to our economy, since we're in multiple major bubbles?
Well, we're in the aftermath of a bubble, and I see a slow crash. We've discussed this before in your show. As long as the Obama administration left the debts in place after 2008, the population at large is having to pay the student debt that you mentioned, the mortgages that they took when a property was high priced. They're having to pay the credit card debt that they've taken out just to live. More and more auto debts that are, by the way, going bad. So you're having just a slow crash. You're going to have more and more stores closing. Here in New York, the New York Times, the New York Post today just talked about all the American stores, the stores in New York that are sort of mainstays of the New York retail scene. They're going out of business. So you're just having a shrinkage. The same thing is happening in Europe. You were right to mention Greece, and if you want to look at what's happening in America, look at what happened has happened in Greece. That's why I devoted three chapters on Greece to my Killing the Host.
Well, Michael, it's always good to have you on to give us an update, and I appreciate you giving some clarity to these issues.
Well, thank you very much, Gary. I'm glad your show is bringing it before the people at large.
Thank you. Michael Hudson at michael-hudson.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Before we take our break, this is just to show you the type of arrogance, the conceit, the self-righteousness of those who claim, whether they were celebrities or television pundits or politicians, that Trump would never be president. Listen in, please.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump. That's not going to happen.
Donald Trump will not be called president.
He's not going to be president. Donald Trump is not going to be president of the United States. take it to the bank. Okay. I guarantee it.
All right, all right.
You think if he becomes the president, he'll make it great because the states is already great.
I think that man will be president of the United States right about the time that spaceships come down filled with dinosaurs and red capes.
On that note, Tom,
take it
Thank
from me.
Much.
How about that?
Yes, Tom,
and then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke.
Donald Trump, just last week, he confirmed to the National Review that he is again considering a run in 2016.
Do it. Do it. Look at me. Do it. I will personally write you a campaign check now on behalf of this country, which does not want you to be president, but which badly wants you to run.
So when you stand and deliver that State of the Union address, in no part of your mind or brain can you imagine Donald Trump standing up one day and delivering a State of the Union address?
Well, I can imagine it in a Saturday night skit.
I continue to believe Mr. Trump will not be president.
He will never be president of the United States.
And we better be ready for the fact that he might be leading the Republican ticket.
Next. I know you don't believe that, but I want to go on.
Sorry to laugh.
Okay, here we are. And which Republican candidate has the best chance of winning the general election?
Of the declared ones right now, Donald Trump.
And so, right now, Mr. Trump, to answer your call for political honesty, I just want to say, you're not going to be president, all right? But come on, buddy. All, let's say, cow poo-poo aside, there is zero chance we'll be seeing you being sworn in on the Capitol steps with your hand on a giant golden Bible.
I'll make a prediction, though, for you. And I don't really get into predictions much, but this one I'll go way out on a limb. Donald Trump will never, ever be president of the United States. That Trump should not be in this race. He's an absurdity. He is a travesty.
Donald Trump will never be elected president of the United States.
Donald Trump is a here today, gone tomorrow candidate for president of the United States. Donald Trump is not going to be president of the United States. Ever respectful of the fact that the people have not voted, he's not going to be president of the United States.
Let's be clear. Donald Trump will lose the election.
I mean, he had a really good chance to be different and really have a chance to change things, but yeah. he doesn't do the work. He's lazy.
We talk about him every day, and we continuously
He's
bashing him.
He's not going to be the president. Don't worry about it.
Exactly.
It has to be a wake-up call to the Republican Party. Despite Boris thinking that Donald Trump could win New York, like this, the presidential race is over.
Could I just cut through? I have one thing to say, one thing only, and that is that this race is over. Tomorrow morning, the money will dry up. The Republicans will start to hide. Trump has no place to go. This race, effectively, as of tonight, is no longer a presidential race. Everything I know about presidential politics, and I've been through five of them, I've never seen one like this. This race is over. You might as well accept it. And the question now is, how do you minimize damage? And the only way you can do that, it seems to me, is to try to grab hold of some old conservative value things and do what Mondale did in 84, which is try to save a few people down ballot. But as far as Donald Trump's concerned, it will never, ever, ever happen.
President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States! At real Donald Trump. Well, at real Donald Trump, at least I will go down as a president.
So I'm going to follow that up with all those very self-righteous liberal minds out there who just never seem to be right with a study from Yale University. And it was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Sociopaths, quote, do experience regret, particularly when their bad decisions affect them directly, yet they don't use that experience to inform their future choices. quote, the popular view of psychopaths is that they're cold, callous, and simply don't care what happens to themselves or anybody else. This, according to the Yale psychologist. But this research shows they can experience negative emotions if they're impacted by the situation personally. Regret is self-focus, whereas remorse involves another. So they have no more remorse. So to all those self-righteous out there, and there's a lot of them, who act like psychopaths or sociopaths, which are most of them, that all believe they're right about everything all the time, that never seem to gain anything from the truth after an event. They didn't gain a truth from the Vietnam War. They didn't gain a truth from the Cold War. They didn't gain any truth from invading Nicaragua and or Barbados or any of the other places that they invaded. They did not gain any insight from Afghanistan, Iraq. They didn't get a single whiff of insight from the Wall Street bailouts and how that hurt us, or sponsoring all the polluting toxic sources of energy, coal, gas, and solar. Those are the classic definitions of sociopaths. But there's also a lot of psychopaths mixed in with them. We don't need any of these. And to add on to something on that, quote, most presidential candidates speak at a 6th to 8th grade level. Trump typically scores lowest. Abraham Lincoln remains the benchmark. And right behind, right beside Trump was Ted Cruz. But Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders both at the same level as well. So I guess to patronize and to try to induce a certain group of people to vote for you, you'll go to that level. But these people live at that level. And that's the fact of it. Before our break, I want to just share some insights because I believe we have to look at history. I believe we have to look at history because we continue to repeat it and without any irony and learn nothing from it. And we have an entire generation, with some exceptions, of course, probably about 5% of the millennial generation are highly sensitive to the issues of today. They're not cupcakes. They are capable of understanding the real world and are actively engaged in trying to do some positive work on it, much like many of us were down in the 1960s and 70s. But you look at the rest of the population. You look at the baby boomers who've gone to sleep behind everything, the senior citizens who don't count for anything as far as social change and social challenge, again, with rare exception. There are exceptions, but the majority, the professional class of over 6 million, doctors, engineers, lawyers, accountants, professors, the academic class, when was the last time you saw them actually lead a march? Join in a march, put themselves at risk. They don't. So exactly who's supposed to learn lessons from our past and engage in the issues of today? If we don't begin to wake up, I believe that we will return to a state similar to that of Rome. According to Pascal Emmanuel Gobry, and anyone who studies ancient history, it's been written about many times, from the early Middle Ages until just a few decades ago, every educated person had to study Greece and the history of Rome, the history of both. And there's a reason for that. And there's a reason why it's a shame we no longer do so. It's not just that history holds important lessons, it's that we live in a time built by dead men who preceded us. America is a constitutional republic. Its governing institutions were imagined and bequeathed to us by a number of men and women who studied the history of Greece and Rome, as did the philosophers and writers and statesmen they took their inspiration from, and those of these people who took their inspiration from others. This democracy we live in is like a piece of foreign machinery we're supposed to operate. If you're not a mechanic, you wouldn't try to fix your car without first trying to read some sort of instructions. In order to understand how our republic works, we need to understand the thoughts of the people who build it. We have to understand where they're coming from. The founding fathers of the United States and the Enlightenment philosophers they learned from and took from, much of our Constitution, much of our Declaration of Independence was taken from European philosophers. Again, the people whose machine were supposed to keep running were all obsessed with Greece and Rome. Now, the reason why speeches from politicians keep referring to America as an experiment in democracy and why there is this sense that they were trying something daring and precarious is because they lived under the shadow of Rome. The common belief until the American founding was that democracy was destined to fail. A political system that promises formal equality cannot bear the strain of a system that will always have inequalities of status, however you try to legitimize them. In a true democracy, demagogues will win over the people with fatuous promises and showy acrobatics and accrue enough power to destroy the very democracy that is the source of their power. Sound remotely familiar to today? And the reason why they believe this was because that's exactly what happened in Rome. Hence the saying, the Republic, if you can keep it. If we know something about the fall of the Roman Republic, we know vaguely about Julius Caesar, about how he was a popular general who used his support within the military to effect a coup. The coup then led to a civil war in which the strong man prevailed. Augustus thought he would do well with the powers Caesar had claimed for himself. If we know a little more, we know that Caesar was not just a successful general, but a canny politician who used his political victories not just to command the personal allegiance of the legions, but to build a populist political power base at home. We might also faintly be aware that by the time Caesar could attempt his coup, the Roman Republic was already exhausted by a complacent elite fattened by centuries of military victory and the attendant spoils. But what historians now refer to as the crisis of the Roman Republic had a deeper class-based component. Like all republics, Rome understood itself through the prism of the myth of its own overthrow of tyrannic rulers and the establishment of the what was called the AM, or a more perfect union. Like all national myths, this was only partly true. In reality, Roman society was divided into two primary classes, the patricians and the plebeians, and three if you count slaves, which you obviously should, although they were less active politically than the other two classes. The patricians were the aristocracy. Today we would call them the elite, the oligarchs, the billionaire class, or those that support them. Remember, around every one of the aristocracy in Rome, you had a whole group of people that facilitated their desires. Rarely did they do anything themselves. They would have scribes that would dictate. They would have then the couriers. They would have the facilitators. They would have the expediters. They would have the people who would take their word or rules of engagement out. Today, we have hundreds of thousands of highly educated, well-groomed, well-qualified technocrats, but they are also the one group today that stands above and beyond, and the patricians are in their class. They also were large landowners in an era where the source of economic power was land. And what's more, while much of Italy was in the theory of a public land, in practice, the patricians could farm those lands and keep the proceeds as if it were their own private property. But they didn't actually have it that way. That's just how power worked. The fact that the patricians could rely on slave labor to farm this land made it even more profitable for them, even as it squeezed the plebeians out of the jobs they might have had farming. This fundamental equality between the land-owning patrician class and the economically insecure plebeians is the most important thing to keep in mind about the history of the late Roman Republic. What about the political system? Well, as it is known, Rome was run by a Senate. But the Senate was actually made up of patricians. And to oversimplify, the Senate was like a legislative branch, which nominated the consuls who ran the executive. Did the plebeians not have a voice? Well, the plebeians were represented by elected officials called tribunes, whose main power was the ability to propose legislation and to veto the Senate. The plebeians were most often wealthy patricians themselves, since it was the only way to be active in politics. But they were patricians with a common touch, and good tribunes, like good politicians, knew how to appeal to their constituencies. In the late 2nd century B.C., decades before Caesar actually rolled around, this crushing inequality gave birth to a political crisis. There were two brothers, Tiberius and Gaius. The Gracchus brothers tried to implement various reforms to rebalance the inequality, including redistribution of land and distributing grain to the Roman poor. Those who were hungry should have something to eat. How did that go? Not so well. In fact, to make it very short, one of the brothers committed suicide rather than fall prey to a lynching by a mob raised by a patrician council to stomp him down by force. The failure of the two brothers did two things. The first was to reestablish the precedent of using force to settle political disputes. And the second was to entrench the class divisions at the heart of the Roman society. And since Rome's complex system of checks and balances, remember, it was always check by the aristocracy class, but a balance by the public, but it would take a long time for the public to finally rise up. And none of that then could fix the problems. And of course, Rome's aristocrats did not believe themselves to simply be defending their pocketbooks. Of course, Rome, after all, was one of the world's most sophisticated civilizations, and its aristocracy was highly educated. It believed that in defending its privileges, they had a right to be rich. Their lands, their buildings, their concubines, whoever they had, it was their right, and Rome was better for it. So we were told. Well, then along came the others who doubted that. They were uneducated. They were coarse. They held beliefs contrary to what it meant to have the values of Rome. So in this background, Rome's government, increasingly implicated in foreign wars and maintaining an empire, had to become more and more militarized and to raise taxes to keep up its expenses. And because those conflicts were so deeply entrenched, Rome kept lurching from one social to political to constitutional crisis year after year, decade after decade, so that by the time a popular strongman came along, the Republic was ripe fruit waiting to be plucked. All of which brings me to our current situation. Have you noticed that millions have left the labor force? By my count, 102 million. As I mentioned to Michael Hudson earlier in the program, how in the world can you say we have an unemployment level of 4.8% when you have 102 million workers who are not working? But that is what people who are in positions of power do. They lie. They manipulate. They always have throughout all of history. That people with college degrees are increasingly locked out of the economy, that the globalized meritocratic system rewards a small elite while leaving everyone else behind. Now, it is not yet the time for a Caesar, yet I believe that we have one of those people in the form of Donald Trump acting as if he were going to rescue, acting as if he were going to change the system and make it more equitable. He will not. Now, we do not yet have the grain riots in America, but you have 32 countries that had food riots in the last 6 months. You will have a patrician class in the United States of about 60 million. It's not 1%, friends. Much higher than that. And the plebeian class, smaller. And then you have the poor. And they're at loggerheads. So if you want to know where all the anger is coming from, you have anger from people who feel that they cannot live a quality life and participate in their dream or even the dreams of their parents. And so they're looking for someone at this time in Washington who will change all that for them. They have been betrayed. They would have been betrayed by the Clintons. They're being betrayed by Trump. And I believe that it's time now for we the people to become fully educated, fully aware of how we got into this mess, so that by the time you start to see social breakdown, by the time the military turns on the people in different demonstrations, which it will, by the time we have our next Kent State, But this time around, we won't just have a Kent State where groups of young people go up and put flowers in the rifle ends of soldiers. This time you're going to have over 100 million armed Americans who feel broke, betrayed, and have nothing to lose. It's just waiting for one spark. And just like the forest fires that have decimated one of the towns in Tennessee, the towns in North Carolina and South Carolina, it's going to happen. It's just when. And history should be a very good indicator that it is going to happen soon. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Get all the love we girls leave behind. The reason I know so much about her is because she picked up a man of mine. Jumping slick was my ruin. I'd like to welcome you. I found out. I'm Gary Nall. A couple of things for those of you who watched the other night, the world premiere over the internet of Plant Codes. We're sorry that so many people could not get on because it was sold out almost instantly. We had people from all over the world. We did not anticipate that amount of people. So we are putting it up so you can watch it at any time, and it should be up and in place later today. Separately, I want to just take a moment because I was thinking of something. As I was walking to work, I had someone stop me who lives in my neighborhood and says, Gary, you know, my wife gets your red stuff and green stuff and stuff, but you're out and you're going to get any in. And I said, well, soon. I said, but there's a product you can buy that gets you a full serving of red stuff and a full serving of Berry Blast in the same product. He said, I didn't know that. I said, yes, it's called Survival Stuff. It's a huge jar. And what you can do is just look at the label. So here's the label. So for those of you who wanted to have red stuff and Berry Blast, and we've been out for about 2 weeks, probably out for another 3 or 4 weeks before we get it back in individual cans. If you get a Survival Stuff for $150 or $155, something like that, very cheap, you're getting both a full 100% red stuff and Berry Blast. Plus, get this, you're getting for free green stuff, greens and grains, cruciferous stuff, muscle stuff, and fiber stuff in the same product. You're getting pea protein and brown rice protein and alfalfa and pumpkin seeds and flax seeds and barley grass, carrots and kale and cauliflower, cabbage and parsley and ginger, spinach and celery and broccoli, asparagus and collard greens and apples, bananas and cranberries and strawberries, chlorella, spirulina, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, kamut juice, oats, sprouted quinoa, kamut, spelt, and amaranth, oat beta-glucan, chia seeds, 5 types of seaweed like Elaria and Dulse and Laminaria, enzymes like protease and amylase and lipase and cellulase and papain and bromelain, 8 billion probiotics. Oh, yeah. Flavored with natural pineapple and cherry flavor. And it's just terrific. 17 grams of protein in a serving, 15 grams of fiber in a serving, and all those fruits and vegetables. Wow. So, and that part is you're not paying for. So, for those of you who want to get your Berry Blast and red stuff right now, call this number and get Survival Stuff, because it's got them both in there. When I made Survival Stuff, I made this huge, like, gallon jar so that you could have that in times of emergency. But it's got everything in there now. And you're saving a tremendous amount, several hundred dollars savings. So call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Remember, you're really only paying for the, and it's $154, that's it. You're not paying the regular price. That means you're getting red stuff You're getting Power Berry Blast. But you're not paying for the green stuff, the greens and grains, the cruciferous stuff, the fiber stuff, and the muscle stuff, of which it's in there also. So I can't imagine a better situation. So now there's no more reason to fret or wait until the new bottled red stuff and Berry Blast come in. It's in production, but it's going to be a couple weeks. So call 877-627-5065. That's 877-627-5065 to get your survival stuff, that huge jar that has everything in it. I put everything in there. So to the gentleman who stopped me on the street, now your wife can have her Berry Blast and red stuff every day, but all the other stuff she's going to get as well. It's all in there. Tastes great. Again, 877-627-5065, a huge saving. You're only paying $154. To the latest on health and healing, some reasons to break a sweat. Why should you break a sweat? Well, because it's the body's own way of cleansing and detoxifying. And that's important. And when you have all the pollutants, the solvents, the fumigants, the insecticides, the particulate matter, the pesticides that are in our environment, all the heavy metals, then you got to get them out of the body because they interfere in how the body functions. So sweating, like in exercising or take a sauna, that helps to eliminate pesticides, including DDT and methoxychlor and indrin, and get them out of the tissues. Also, the plasticizers, the phthalates, found in plastic products, it helps get them out. Heavy metals, it'll help get the heavy metals like nickel, cadmium, and lead, aluminum, and mercury out of the body. So when you sweat, you're detoxifying. So it's healthy to sweat. From the Federal University in Santa Maria, Brazil, breast cancer healing potential found in cat's claw, says the study. Quote, great news for breast cancer patients. The rainforests of the world are said to contain over 5 million healing substances, with more being discovered every year. One such plant that has been known for its effect on cancer for almost 100 years is undigata, or cat's claw. And the evidence has been mounting about how this plant can help heal cancer on several fronts. And cat's claw was first shown to have anti-cancer effects back in the 1920s. So add that to the list of things that can make a difference. Also, this is from George Monbiot, and he's a social critic, really interesting person, very educated on world events. Here's an article he wrote, and it says, why I took the plunge at last and converted almost to veganism. The world can cope with 7 or even 10 billion people, but only if we stop eating meat. Livestock farming is the most potent means by which we amplify our presence on the planet. It's the amount of land an animal-based diet needs that makes it so destructive. An analysis by the farmer and scholar Simon Farley suggests that Britain could easily feed itself within its own borders. But while a diet containing a moderate amount of meat and eggs and dairy would require the use of 11 million hectares of land, 4 million of which would be arable, a vegan diet would require less than 3 million. Not only do humans need no pasture, but we use grains and pulses more efficiently when we eat them ourselves. This would enable 15 million hectares of land now used for farming to be set aside for nature. Alternatively, on a vegan planet, Britain would feed 200 million people. It's not hard to see extending this thought experiment to the rest of the world. How gently we could tread if we stop keeping animals. Rainforests, savannas, wetlands, magnificent wildlife can live alongside us, but not alongside our current diet. And because we have failed to understand this in terms of space, we believe we can solve the problem by switching from indoor production to free-range meat and eggs. Nothing could be further from the truth. Free-range farming is kinder to livestock but crueler to the rest of the living world. When people criticize farming, they preface it with the words intensive. But extensive farming, almost by definition, does greater harm. More land is needed to rear the same amount of food. Keeping cattle or sheep on ranches, whether in the Amazon, the U.S., Australia, or the hills of Britain, is even more of a planet-busting indulgence than feedlots for beef and hog cities, though they're cruel and hideous. Over several years, as I became more aware of this inconvenient truth, I gradually dropped farmed meat from my diet, but I still ate meat and milk and eggs. I knew the dire environmental impacts of the crops, such as maize and soy, on which dairy cows and chickens are fed. I knew about the waste, the climate change, the air pollution, but greed got the better of me. Cheese, yogurt, butter, eggs, I love them all. Then something happened that broke down the wall of denial. Last September, I arranged to spend a day beside the River Colne in Devon, renowned for its wildlife and beauty. But the stretch I intended to explore had been reduced to a stinking ditch, almost lifeless except for sewage fungus. I traced the pollution back to a dairy farm. A local man told me the disaster had been developing for months, but his efforts to persuade the environmental agency, the government regulator, to take action had been fruitless. I published the photos I had taken in the Guardian newspaper, and then it caused a stir. Still, however, the environmental agency refused to take action. Its excuses were so preposterous that I realized this was more than simply incompetence. After publishing another article about this farce, I was contacted separately by two staff members of the agency. They told me they had been instructed to disregard all incidents of this kind. The cause, they believed, was political pressure from the government. That did it. Why, I reasoned, should I support an industry the government refuses to regulate? Since then, I have cut almost all animal products from my diet. I'm not religious about it. I'm not at a friend's house, being rabid about vegetarianism. If I'm away from home, I will drop some milk into my tea. About once a fortnight, I have an egg for my breakfast. Perhaps once a month, fish that I catch, or a herring, or some anchovies. And perhaps three or four times a year, on special occasions, I'll eat some meat. Partly out of greed, partly because I don't want to even be more of a specter at the feast than I am already, this slight adaptation, I feel, reduces the chances that I will relapse. My rough calculations suggest that 97% of my diet now consists of plants. I eat plenty of pulses, seeds, nuts, and heaps of vegetables. That almost allows me to join the 500,000 people in Britain who are full vegans, but not quite. Of course, these choices also have impacts, but they are generally far lower than those of meat, dairy, and eggs. If you want to eat less soya, eating animal products tends to mean consuming far more of this crop, albeit indirectly. Replacing meat with soya reduces the clearance of natural vegetation per kilogram of protein by 96%. After almost a year on this diet, I have dropped 12 stone. I feel better than I've done for years. My craving for fat has all but disappeared. Cheese is no more appealing to me now than a lump of lard. My asthma has almost completely gone. There are a number of possible explanations, but I wouldn't be surprised if it had something to do with cutting out milk. I have to think harder about what I cook, but that is not a bad thing. Meat eating is strongly associated with conventional images of masculinity, and some people appear to feel threatened by those who give up animal products. An Italian politician this week proposed jailing parents who impose a vegan diet on their children in case it leaves them malnourished. Curiously, he failed to recommend the same sanctions for feeding them on chips and sausages. By chance, at a festival this summer, I met the man from Devon who had tried to persuade the environmental agency to take action on the River Colne. He told me that nothing has changed. When there's a choice between protecting the living world and appeasing powerful lobbying groups, most governments will take the second option. But we can withdraw our consent, from this corruption if we exercise that choice. I doubt you will regret it. And that's George Monbiot talking about how he became a vegan. And that's good. And finally, there is, I thought this was an interesting study. It's from University of Utah. It says, religious and spiritual experiences activate the brain reward circuits in much the same way as love, sex, gambling, drugs, music. And that it was published in the Social Neuroscience. Quote, we're just beginning to understand how the brain participates in experiences that believers interpret as spiritual, divine, or transcendent. In the last few years, brain imaging technologies have matured in ways that are letting us approach questions that have been around for millennia. So what they're finding is that they're finding when, like, I love listening to gospel music, and boy, you feel it. It just reverberates. And if you're motivated by what the pastor, the rabbi, the imam, or whoever is saying to you, the environment you're in, and sharing that with other people, it's creating a whole lot of excitement in the brain, and that's maturing very much like, well, as if you had sex or if you were in love. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.